let me begin by collecting a few numbers. This will be the only interruption, otherwise I'll talk and then you can continue eating. The test is going to be sort of critical numbers for transitions in shear flows. We'll see what kind of numbers we come up with. The first flow I suggest to look into is pipe flow. Well, critical, I mean the following, not talking about linear instability, but suppose that you set up pipe flow and the various other flows that I'll come to in a minute, and then you perturb the thing sufficiently strongly, and then you can make it undergo some kind of transition to something which you might call turbulent. 2,000 upwards. Ah, so we got 2,000 here. We got 2,200. 2,000 is sort of a number you can find in most textbooks. Different game. Yeah, that gives you 20.
That's 97 or something.
Yeah, something ridiculous, low and irrelevant. I'm going to show you something that goes down to 1,700. Okay? Good. So there is some variability there. You don't worry about it? Okay. So what curriculum went on somewhere do you know about plain quiet flow?
1,500.
In what units?
Based on a half channel, it's about 1,500. I can tell you how well I get the number.
Half channel with 1,500.
Maybe 12, I don't know.
What kind of this
1,200? Based on channel with 1,200.
Yeah? Okay.
It doesn't matter.
It does make a difference.
You don't have to quantify all this.
Our teacher says you can hit it as hard as you want.
Yes. You're entitled to doing whatever you like, and you just make the transition to turbulence. So, plain quiet flow, and this is why I asked about how the Reynolds number is defined. If it's you base it on the full channel width and the full velocity difference, because that doesn't make a difference. Normally, and the numbers I'll be using later are based on half the width and half the velocity difference. So there is a factor of 4 involved, and with that factor of 4, you get indeed something of the order of 1,200. Took down 1280. Let me take 1280. That will be the number I'll reproduce. Yeah.
Yes.
What numbers are there around for the Blasius boundary layer?
Based on delta star or what?
And something like the width and then the velocity difference to the mean flow. I mean, if you take it with the momentum difference or with sort of 90%.
It's about 300. Yeah. 350. Yeah, something like that.
Oh, this is interesting. How much do you get?
It's about 330. If you want delta star, you just multiply by 1.4.
I had something on the order of 1,000, but even with 1.4, I don't quite get there. Okay. Yeah. Yeah, okay, fine. now we got Poiseuille flow.
Poiseuille
explain Poiseuille flow. So it's pressure driven.
I give a number 1500, but I'm not sure that it's based on half channel or full channel height, so I'll find it to 1500.
I got 1000.
Based on half channel, but I'm not entirely sure.
I got something like 1000 based on the mean velocity and the full diameter, which if you now go back to the gradient, which is the maximum velocity and half the channel width, I got something like 350. Now. Yes. Now there are two lessons I think one can draw from these numbers. The first one is, except for this boundary layer, this I find disturbing. You can sort of rationalize the trend from the large ones up there to the smaller ones down there by saying something about the boundaries being involved. You have rigid boundaries for the plane grad flow. You have a sort of a strange geometry where the middle part, the gradient, only exists along a line, and so there are geometric influences which maybe drive the Reynolds number a bit higher. And when you come to plane Poiseuille flow, it has a rigid wall and it has sort of a soft wall in the center when you have this maximum velocity gradient. The other thing which I find a lot more interesting is there doesn't seem to be any agreement as to what this number is. Now, even if you sort of sort out the problems with the definition on what length and what velocity you take, if you look in different papers, you can find a whole variety of these numbers, which is something apparently principal to the problem we're looking at. And part of the reason for that is that all these flows, as I've given them here, do not have a linear instability in this range of Reynolds numbers. They're all linearly stable. But the others are linearly stable. And this is why this thing comes in, that you have to drive them sufficiently hard and that you have to take a perturbation which is sufficiently strong to make them undergo some kind of transition. A critical Reynolds number seems to be ill-defined and to depend very much on the kind of experiment and the measures you apply to it. Okay.
Once the perturbation reaches a sufficient magnitude, it doesn't matter whether you're going to make it even larger.
No. No. There is, so what you would find in many cases, if this is some measure of amplitude of your perturbation and this is some measure of Reynolds number, if the amplitudes are small, then this transitional border extends all the way out to infinity, and then some typically, this is the kind of situation you would like to have. That it sort of bends up and maybe diverges at some finite Reynolds number. However, the way it comes out is that this looks more like so, if anything.
It's partly because nobody has really taken the trouble of characterizing it really accurately.
Yeah.
Little detail. And, so nobody has actually bothered to look at this very carefully.
Okay. I'll tell you what we can contribute to this in the case of plane grad flow. This will be my prime example. Now, in view of this fundamental problem, that there is no linear instability, people have started looking at various other possibilities of inducing something in that system. And one of the more popular problems has been this issue of non-normal amplification. That's the way it's called in the mathematical literature. In the engineering literature, it has been around somewhat longer. I think this goes back to Landau. It's been called lift-up effect. Now, The basic idea behind that is that in these systems you have linear stability, but the eigenvalue problem that you're solving is not Hermitian, as in we're all familiar in quantum mechanics. And therefore, since it's not Hermitian, the eigenvectors don't have to be orthogonal, and if the eigenvectors are not orthogonal, then there can be transient phenomena on the linear level induced by precisely this fact that eigenvectors are not orthogonal and can lead to some amplification. How does this come about with the view to the kind of applications that I have in mind? Suppose that I take a shear flow. Just want to make sure that I get the numbers right. So I have a basic profile, which is alpha set 0, 0. So x is downstream direction, y is wall normal, spanwise, and z is wall normal, and I have a flow that sort of goes like this. Now, if I superimpose on that flow a perturbation, which looks like so, let me call it. It's an amplitude times a flow which goes in x direction but has a spanwise modulation. This is plain Kreutz flow, and I will continue for most of what I'm doing for plain Kreutz flow. Now, this is a kind of flow which goes in streamwise direction, but the speed depends on the height in which you are. That's the set dependence, but it's also modulated in streamwise direction. And you add to that something which looks like a downstream vortex. There is some amplitude dependence, which is not so important. Sign KYY. Now, what that is, if you sort of look downstream, this goes into the plane and this comes out of the plane, then this is sort of this kind of vortex motion. Streamwise vorticity. So you have streamwise vorticity and then the spanwise modulation. Now you put that back into the linearized Navier-Stokes equation, you sort out terms, you drop everything you don't like, and then you end up with an equation which looks like this. Pardon? First of all, you do this linearized. Secondly, I've been liberal about boundary conditions. The linear shear flow has, of course, rigid boundaries on top and bottom. This one doesn't anymore. It's these kinds of things that you drop. I'm not going higher order and more in modes and so forth. So the equations you get look like this. A dot is minus nu kz squared plus ky squared a. That's nice and simple. And B dot is also damped. That's a minus nu k z squared plus k y squared B. And if this were all, things would be trivial and boring because everything decays. Now the fun comes in when this streamwise vortex starts playing with this kind of downstream modulation, which is sometimes called a streak. In the following sense, you get a coupling. That this is B times KY alpha divided by KZ squared plus KY squared. And what this means is that a decaying vortex will still induce a downstream a modulation of the downstream velocity, which can amplify this, and it's only when D is gone that A gets a chance to decay. This is this transient amplification that if you have a downstream vortex, it can drive a streak intermediately, at least. And alpha is the shear. So no shear, no amplification. Stronger shear, stronger amplification.
So you chose this particular type of perturbation, I suppose, for a good reason.
Yes.
Are there other types of perturbations that also give you the same non-normal amplification?
This one is chosen such that if you now look at sort of keep KZ, the wave number in Z direction, fixed. Now it's clear if you make this thing modulated then with more than just the sign in the Z direction, you will get more damping. So the smallest damping you get if you just take a cosine mode or a sine mode, so if KZ equals pi. And then you can ask yourself, what's the optimal KY with a maximum amplification? Yeah, I'll get to that. So from that, what you find is that the KY, for which all this is maximal, is KZ over square root 2. Now, this is what we were after in this kind of calculation. Now, you can, of course, ask, are these the only ones? Well, there has been a detailed study, including correct boundary conditions and everything, by Farrell and Ioanno, as to what are the modes that grow fastest and have the weakest decays of us in this problem. And what they find is something that is pointing downstream with hardly any modulation. And the wave numbers are sort of compatible in the sense that if you take rigid walls, you know that they're going to shrink a little bit, whereas if you take these free slip boundary conditions, they're a bit broader. So in that sense, these are close to motivations.
So axial vorticity is the important ingredient.
Yes.
Yeah.
And we will see this again when we come to asking for this mechanism of what's going on. Now, this non-normal amplification business you can now play in various flows. It has been done for pipe flow. It has for plain grad flow. It has been done for pipe flow. People must have looked at it for Poiseuille flow. What it explains or can explain is how, because of the shear and because of the coupling between these modes, a small perturbation can be amplified, even within the linear theory. Now, the amplification, I didn't put the numbers in here, is such that it grows by a factor of order Reynolds number on a time which is proportional to Reynolds number. And this has been used or interpreted as the main mechanism that gives the sensitivity of these flows to perturbations. Because no matter what you add as a perturbation, it gets amplified and it grows in amplitude. And then the idea is, of course, well, if it grows larger enough in amplitude, then the nonlinear terms become important, and then something has to happen to that system. That's where you pretty much have to leave the standard analytical approaches, and where you have to go into some numerics. But before I do that, let me show you one result on pipe flow, which I like very much. This is an experiment by Derbyshire and Mullen, shown as here a Reynolds number, and here a measure of the disturbance amplitude. They had a sort of a way of inducing, I think, spiral type and counter spiral type perturbations in the flow. So that they could reproduce, within the limits of the experiments, of course, given amplitudes. This is the Reynolds number, and you see it reaches down to 1800, and that's not the minimum yet. There is another experiment with 1700 something. Yes. And so here is the amplitude before you get something, and then these symbols here, and I apologize for the poor quality, but that's what I got out of the paper by magnifying. There are two sets of symbols. There are these filled squares, which are perturbations that by the end of their tunnel were decayed. And then there are these crosses indicating perturbations that by the end of their tunnel were still turbulent. And what you see is that there is no clear border between the two. You have turbulent ones with a neighborhood of decaying ones around them, and you have decaying ones in a region where many others stay turbulent. So this begins to show why there is sort of an experimental problem as to when you set one of these boundaries, because if you repeat the experiment, even though it looks like a same or a similar amplitude, stuff can decay. Yes. One would have to look again in the details as to how they do it. They have a way of inducing jets at several points around the pipe. You can take all of them, you can push in one and suck in the others. So there are various ways of arranging it. And then this is a measure of, I think, the pressure drop they applied from the outside for the jet. Yes. Well, this is something they drew in by hand. There isn't. I mean, if it, you were to draw something, it would be very fractal-like. Now, the colored ones are the ones that I picked out to indicate that you have decaying ones in a neighborhood of predominantly ones, and these, yeah. No. 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 I'm sorry, no.
No, Mullin did this work when he was still in Oxford.
Yes, yes. The figure he gives in his paper is not this for the experimental setup. The former. The experiment is... No, I'll tell you the former.
The perturbations are not controlled very well. The perturbations are not controlled very well.
You're sort of taking... this is what I'm after in the following. What I'll be showing you is a theoretical concept and a picture backed up by numerics, which suggests that what he's seeing here is, of course, influenced by details of the experiment. But there is an underlying principal problem in even if you do it numerically, you wouldn't get anything better.
But is this not a deterministic system?
Yeah, the question of determinism.
Is it an identical experiment?
We'll get to that. It's, of course, a question of sort of what you call identical and whatnot, or reproducible or not. So, let me see. I want to keep my transparencies ordered. So I know which one. This is one. Well, even if you don't put it in garbage, you get this garbage out. Okay. So what we did was we set out for plane quad flow. Why does a theorist take plane quad flow? Very simple Cartesian geometry. You take Fourier modes in streamwise direction, spanwise direction. You have to fiddle a little bit in normal direction. We take Legendre polynomials in order to get something that satisfies the boundary conditions. And then you have to choose a box size and you start integrating. Now, the first sort of things you get are the kinds you'd expect to get, which is to say you have time here, energy in the perturbation as sort of a measure of the perturbation, then also the mean shear, if you like. If you're low in Reynolds number at about 250, stuff makes a little wiggle, decays, that's it, the time is very short. If you go higher up in Reynolds number, about 300, you get a few more wiggles, but eventually it dies off, but this is a time of about 800 compared to the 50 you had earlier. You go to 350, the stuff wiggles even longer, and by the time you run out of patience, or computing time by 3000, it still oscillates. So this is something you'd call a turbulent signal, and this is maybe a transient.
But if you waited long enough, let's say 6,000 or 100,000,
yes,
whatever, would that be a transient? Or how do you make a distinction between transient?
I can't.
No. But here it does not be. Somebody tells you that it's comfortable. If it's transient.
There are too many discussions here. No. This would only go if it were linear transient. So for the top half, you're right. But for the turbulent ones, you're not right. No. For these down here, you're not right. It doesn't go with Reynolds number. But it's decaying. This one is not decaying on a time scale which is in any way related to the Reynolds number, but it is decaying.
You mean second scale?
Yes. This is a long-lived transient. And there is nothing, to come back to your question, anywhere along the trajectory to figure out, say up to time 600, you have to bet whether it decays or not. Chances are 50-50. No way to tell. In these sort of natural units that go with that. Viscosity, viscous time, distance of viscosity. Doesn't help. Now this is a very interesting discussion, as you see. Take that signal down there. Divide it up in 3 clocks of 1,000. Each one of them will look perfectly nice, statistically well behaved. How do you know that this doesn't continue? How do you know that this really continues forever?
But if you look at the second picture, it's certainly not a statistical instead, you give them, let's say,
because the time
you restrict it by 800, say, where your indicator has started, it is clearly not statistical.
Okay. This is why I like the experiments on plain quartz flow, because they don't have this problem that the stuff gets washed away and that you have to build a facility that's 100 meters long. At least from the mean velocity vanishing, in principle, you sort of could watch it for a longer time. And there you see similar kinds of behavior. Now, this question of whether something is stationary or not and the possibility of deciding whether it's stationary or not is to a large extent at the heart of this kind of problem. What we've collected here are lifetimes of perturbations, and the cutoff at 3,000 comes basically because of our patience in computing time. We did some more going higher up, but again. This is Reynolds number. This is our measure of amplitude.
3,000 units would be something like 30 heights of the channel and time depth and time flow of the channel, 30 channels, 30 light or 60, something like that.
I never translated like that. I've looked at the experiments of Tao Shou and it's a few minutes. No, I never looked at sort of the traveling distance of the belts.
Yeah. The reason I ask is, I mean, many of these problems, the conventional wisdom is you need hundreds of channels per diameter for observing anything really developed. So if it only goes, say, 30 or so height of the channel, it's not clear that you have really reached the asymptotic frequency set.
That's something you'd have to discuss with Tao Shou. I'm sorry for that. So what we collected in these two pictures are lifetimes, and should say that you can read off lifetimes from these figures by putting some level in the energy amplitude, in particular on the set component, because the set component is driving the whole thing. So if the energy content of the set component falls below a certain level, it cannot revive, and then you know you've made it. So we take that time and we just ask, how long do we have to integrate before we get there? And this is now a combination of these are two sets for two different sets of initial conditions. So again, Reynolds number, the measure of the amplitude, and then the time. And what you see is that down here, small Reynolds number, small amplitude, the stuff is pretty much flat. High Reynolds number, large amplitudes, it always reaches the 3,000. And in between, there is this rough landscape where the stuff sort of goes up. Now, in one case, the initial condition was a vortex. I have to guess. We always took vortices, because the experiment of Dalshow, what they do is they shoot a jet of water across, or they put a ribbon spanwise across the channel. And the idea sort of is that this generates some kind of vorticity which can be oriented as a vortex ring downstream in one normal direction or in spanwise direction. And this is for one, and this is for another orientation, and the third one I don't have here. They sort of look similar. Now, in a model, slightly different geometry, that captures, as far as I'm concerned, the essential elements of this experiment. What you can do is you can sort of fix the Reynolds number, take a small interval in amplitude, and go to finer and finer details, and ask yourself, what do you end up with? Yes.
It would imply that, you know, the difference in the experiments is actually in the initial condition. And unless you get the initial condition exactly the same, you won't get the same result.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that if you make a tiny, tiny change in your initial conditions, then the lifetime of what you see can vary by a lot. So this is a sequence of magnifications in some units of an interval from 5 to 6 by 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 down to 10 to the minus 7. And if you take a segment here and you take a segment there and you compare the two, then they're very similar. Meaning that the lifetime as a function of, in this case, the amplitude, but you can play the same game with fixed amplitude of the perturbation and Reynolds number, is very much a fractal kind of plot. So now comes again the question. If you make a tiny, tiny change in initial conditions, the evolution of the whole thing will stay the same for a very long time, and then one decides to stay on for 3,000 and the other one decides to drop off. How can you tell before you actually do it? I mean, before you reach that time, how can you tell that one is going to continue and the other one is going to decay? And this, as I will argue later, I think is intrinsic to this kind of transition, that if you look at these lifetimes as sort of a cutoff at a certain level, they're inherently sensitive to Reynolds number and amplitude of perturbation, and therefore it becomes very tricky to define the sharp transition in the sense of you do one experiment and you don't decay, and you do experiments with a larger Reynolds number and you always get turbulence.
Did I ask, because you haven't gone beyond 3,000,
yes.
Suppose I said, instead of 3,000, I use 1,500.
Yes.
Would the picture change the
labeling
quality? Suppose I say I run out of
patients, but 1,500
instead of
3,000. I will come to some statistical measures which make clearer the answer to that. In the sense, if you look at, say, the median in lifetimes, this would sort of go down. The Reynolds number, where the more than half of the initial conditions reach the maximum integration time, goes down a little bit. That's what you can read off from this slope. In that sense, it depends a little bit on the time. But the difference between the 3,000 and the 20,000 Dalshow could do is minimal. So to come back to this one picture, which is sort of right there underneath with the amplitudes, one of the things you can now play with is that you take this picture, take every pixel, there are 40 by 40 of them, you do a little smoothing, and then you look for the median of the lifetime of these 25 initial conditions that you get in that box, and then you end up with this kind of picture, which here has the Reynolds number, one way, doesn't produce too well, the amplitude the other way, And then the color coding of the lifetimes. Now this is this plateau I was talking about. These are all the turbulent ones. And down here are the planes, where the lifetime is indeed viscously proportional to the Reynolds number. And then here you have this transition region. And what you notice is that it sort of goes up very steeply once you exceed a certain amplitude. And you can now sort of start drawing lines and say, okay, transition at about 310 on average. Another way of extracting the statistical measure is, again, to fix the Reynolds number and to look at the median of the lifetimes. And the reason we take the median and not the average is because we have a drop-off at 3,000. So the full symbols mark the median. And you see it reaches, for this one orientation, the vortex at about 320, for the other one at about 310. And here it's again closer to 320. But you also notice that the first appearance of the initial conditions that live longer than the integration time is at a much lower Reynolds number. So now you've got a few numbers to choose from as to what you call the transition. And this is nicely collected in the experimental data of Lao Shou. This is the transparency he provided. You have experimental data on plane gradient flow, on the apparatus. I didn't get into that. With counter-moving belts. The yellow circles are initial conditions that sort of had some wiggle and then decayed. The red elements in here indicate initial conditions that had some kind of longer-term turbulent fluctuations before they decayed. And then the pink ones here are initial conditions that never decayed during the time of the experiment. And you can see sort of a transitional region. You have almost only decaying stuff basically down here. You have a few longer-lived transients up to about there. And then you have the region where they live as long as you're able to run the experiment. And then you can draw another line which separates. So this is sort of the predominantly turbulent one. This is turbulent and transition in here. And this is the decaying parts down there. Now this is sort of the, we like this agreement with experiment. This is all I wanted to say about this.
Yes. If all this suggests that the amplitude is not enough of the characterization, so maybe you need something more of the characterization. Maybe there's more than just a plane, maybe a three-dimensional diagonal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, something like that.
Meaning, in particular, in the system, if you take a modulation, a perturbation which is only a modulation of the streamwise velocity, translationally invariant, you can take arbitrary amplitudes. No matter at what Reynolds number you are, it will always decay. Things will get worse, even worse. As to the measure, the question of these time scales, if you look at this escape rate, the lower half, ignore the top part, as a function of Reynolds number, so the inverse of that would be sort of a mean lifetime that you can extract from it. Now this is logarithm linear plot. If you try to put a straight line there, it doesn't quite work. And this means that the lifetime seems to increase on average faster than exponentially with Reynolds number. Now, this is something that has been seen in a number of these high-dimensional spatially extended systems in the Kuramoto-Shibashinsky equation. There was the first example where the lifetime increased like e to the n to, I forgot what power, square, something like that. And something similar seems to happen here. That is, if you increase the Reynolds number, the lifetime takes off very quickly. Now, whether it ever gets to infinity so that you have a real attractor, we don't know. But for all practical purposes, it seems to go into something turbulent.
You didn't say anything about relaxation.
Now, this relaxation business is... if you're at this Reynolds number somewhere around about here, you do have or can induce a turbulent state. Now this turbulent state, because of this escape, may decay, but it also has some kind of stability property to it, in the sense if you start perturbing it, say by adding some energy in some mode, it will relax to it. So this is a timescale for relaxation to the turbulent state, and this is for the timescale for escaping from it. Pardon?
No, I was asking Mark if he understands what you're saying.
Okay, the idea is the following. Let's go back to the lifetimes. Heck, I can take this one. If you take any one of these curves, this one here, or this one, this one's not so good, but this one is sort of nice. What you see is that the median in lifetime increases with Reynolds number, meaning that if you're creating a turbulent state, say it's somewhere 310, 315, more than half of your initial conditions live longer than about 2,000. And now you can sort of look at it the other way around. Suppose you prepare a turbulent state. Now you ask yourself, you randomly spring initial conditions in that turbulent part of phase space, how long does it take for them on average to decay? Which is sort of the inverse of that. And so that's the number that I'm plotting as this escape rate, eta. Meaning if I prepare a turbulent state, and I try to run it as long as I'm willing to follow, how long can I follow it before it decays on average? And this is sort of a lifetime of that thing, and that increases very quickly. This other number is something, suppose you have a turbulent state and you add a little perturbation. How will the energy relax to the typical turbulent energy?
I have to say what threw me off. The curve is going down and it's increasing.
It's a rate. It's an inverse time. I'm sorry for that. Yeah. Okay. Now I promised I would sort of give you a picture as to why I think what is the origin of all these randomness in that system. And one clue as to how one can go about it and what's going on comes from quite Taylor flow, something you probably have all seen before. So it's flow between rotating cylinders, and this is the typical kind of, that's actually an old transparency, you probably have better ones, on the various structures that you see in this, if the curvature is important and the radius ratio of inner radius to outer radius is about 0.8 something. Now if you go up, you have first the strength, if you keep the outer one stationary and rotate the inner one, you have the first instability to formation of Taylor vortices. But if you keep going, these vortices are modulated in axial direction. This is this wavy vortex flow. Now what I want to do is plane quartz flow. So the way to get plane quartz flow is to make the radii larger and larger and larger, so that the curvature becomes less and less important. And then one of the things one knows is that this instability, the red one by Taylor, goes up as far as the rotation speed of the inner cylinder is concerned, all the way up to infinity, it disappears. However, these wavy vortices, once you have them, you can start increasing the radius, and they don't go away. So if eta is now not the escape rate, but the radius ratio, inner to outer cylinder, and this is a Reynolds number based on the velocity difference, then you have this green curve, which is the instability to Taylor vortices. This diverges as eta goes to 1. But the red ones are the Taylor, the wavy vortices, and they cross over and become a subcritical bifurcation at a Reynolds number of about 120. Now this state, when you go all the way to plane quartz flow, persists. This was discovered first, I think, by Nagata. This Reynolds number that I just gave, the 120, is based on half the gap width and half the velocity difference. So it's the same Reynolds number that you would form for plane crest flow. And so what you get is this kind of flow. You have one blade moving this way, the other way, blade moving, the top one moving into the wall. The arrows are the two-dimensional velocity field, and the color coding is the wall normal component, and all of this at a distance which is 0, 1/4, 1/8, 1/4, 1/2 of the downstream wavelength of the periodicity of that pattern. And what you see is you have here these vortices, this one moving upwards, this one going downwards, and then they're a little bit modulated in downstream direction.
What flow is this? And
this is the perturbation added on top of plane crest flow corresponding to this wavy vortex flow. So you're pulling wavy vortex flow over to plane crest flow to get these kinds of structures. And what this indicates is that it's a three-dimensional flow where the vortex center moves a little bit. This is why it's called wavy vortex flow. Close to this 120. Now, if you do a downstream average of this, and this is why I went through this calculation, you see that the downstream average of this flow is very much the kind of perturbation that I was considering over there. Meaning that in this flow, the shear amplifies these downstream vortices, and then by some nonlinear interaction they can actually form a stationary pattern. Now this is...
You should take a minute to explain this graph.
This is looking downstream with one plate going up this way, the other plate disappearing into the wall. This is, again, the arrows are the velocity field in the plane. Now all of this is averaged in downstream direction. And the color coding is the flow velocity into the wall. And so you have, let me see, there is fluid from up here transported down there. So this one is sort of faster, velocity component should go the other way. So there is a velocity difference of the fluid that comes down there compared to what it would be, and the same in that direction, and all of this is transported around by this vortex. Yes.
And it doesn't depend certainly on perturbation?
No, this is a stationary state. It's a three-dimensional... Oh, you sort of find some initial condition, then you use a Newton method to run it until it's really stationary. This is a three-dimensional, or actually a spatial average of a three-dimensional stationary state in plane crest flow. Non-trivial three-dimensional topology. That's what I had in the transparency before.
I was only interested in knowing whether the Reynolds number was above this wavy onset or below the wavy onset, but obviously above.
It is above, and yeah. Yes. But this 120 is a factor of 3 below the 320 we had earlier for the critical Reynolds number. Now, if you work a bit harder, which is what Armin Schmiegel will always be famous for, looking for stationary states in the system, you find lots of them, different colors, different states, different symbols, lots of bifurcations, very interesting structure in there. This is the one that I was showing earlier. And these open symbols with their error bars sort of around indicate where the turbulent states live, where the fluctuations are. So the open circles are the mean, and then you have error bars around indicating where the fluctuations are. And it's clear that as far as the energy is concerned, all these fluctuations live in a tiny part of phase space, and there are lots of orbits going on all around them. And the way the two are connected is sort of not entirely clear. But it is indicative that this orbit there, the first one I was just showing, may not be all too relevant for the turbulent fluctuations because it lives in a totally different part of phase space. Now, oh, this is sort of a one-dimensional cross or a projection of this, in our case, thousand-dimensional phase space onto one scalar variable. I would have loved to bring along a thousand-dimensional presentation of this, but
no,
sort
but
of tricky.
Means that all these lines that are drawn here will also depend on the initial conditions.
No, no. They're stationary solutions, period. I mean, if you now add shear and if you add some components, then they will unfold. They will not necessarily cross.
Yeah.
The only thing that is sort of due to this projection is the crossing. But these lines are lines in this high-dimensional space.
I may be confused by what you're saying. For the problem that you solve for the Coulomb
yes.
flow, I thought the Reynolds number was
Reynolds
number 300 or whatever. Yes. And the wavy vortex which you just showed has a Reynolds number, physical Reynolds number 120.
Yes.
But the wavy vortex is the part of perturbation you just produced here.
Yes.
Right, in your calculation.
Yes.
So how do you reconcile this fact of 2.5 or 3 or almost 2?
I don't know. I can give you a suggestion as to what may be going on in that system. Now. Yes. should be wrapping up, but I'm almost done. I'm almost done. Let's come back to the picture. The idea is we have somewhere in phase space. Now this is again a two-dimensional projection of a thousand-dimensional space. We have our laminar flow, which is stable. So no matter where you start, you always collide. Then we have lots of these stationary states. And as it turns out, almost all of them are unstable. Except this one here in a Reynolds number interval of about 2 and maybe a few others at the points of bifurcation. All the others are unstable. Or, be precise, they have a few unstable directions because the remaining ones have to be contracting. So you have saddles all over phase space. Whoops, this should be going this way and that way. And now the thing that matters is how these saddles are connected, if they're connected at all. Meaning that if they sit just somewhere in phase space and all these directions find their way down here, nothing's going to happen. They're just sitting there. Maybe they attract an initial condition, but it immediately decays. However, if the stable and unstable manifolds of these things begin to cross, and if you have heteroclinic connections between them, then you're in business as far as sustaining a turbulent time signal is concerned, because you can be shuffled back and forth between all of them. And then you have to find sort of a hole through which to escape to get down to this laminar profile. Now, one way of... Now, clearly what you would like to do is calculate this heteroclinic bifurcation in this thousand-dimensional space. We haven't done that yet. But what we did instead was to look at...
You have only that many curves because you ran out of Greek alphabet.
Yes. We could switch to Chinese afterwards. Or kanji or whatever. So this is now at a Reynolds number of 200. Again, a two-dimensional projection of all the stationary states. Now, this is a cross-section at a fixed Reynolds number. In a two-dimensional plane spent by energy and some measure of the shear. The open circles are stationary states that are boring in the sense of you start somewhere near them, you immediately drop down to the laminar profile, nothing is happening. The red ones are the more interesting ones because if you start there, you do make some excursions which bring you into the neighborhood of a few of these other states, but they're just a few connections. This, by the way, is the one I was showing earlier, which is sort of way off. It lives in a part of phase space you typically don't get to. Now, when you increase the Reynolds number just a little bit to 240, what happens is not only is the number of points increasing, but also the number of connections between them, which we take as indicative for this kind of mechanism, that as you increase the Reynolds number, you get more and more of these connections. You have lots of loops where you can sort of loop around between heteroclinic connections, sort of between these points. And if you now look at where the turbulent signal sits, it sits right in the middle where most of these are nested. So the idea is that the turbulence in the system is connected with the formation of these heteroclinic connections between these many stationary states, which then in this area can sustain the turbulent motion. Now, if this is so, if you indeed have the formation of this kind of repeller structure, then you immediately see why the boundary is wiggly, because you have to sort of aim directly at this kind of thing. And if you move around a little bit, you're dropping off. You have an extremely sensitivity to amplitude. You immediately get the time dependence of the excited state because it's always shuffling back and forth. It's never settling to something stationary. And, well, when I wrote this, I was more optimistic than I am now. It indicates the flow structures in the sense of the stationary states always have these downstream vortices. And if you take a cross-section through the turbulent signals of flows of Daoshou, you also see these vortices. I think we're beginning to make some progress on this question of why these bifurcations appear at 120, but turbulence doesn't show up until 350. This is because this forest of connections has to form and grow. That's something I don't think, I have no idea how we will be able to answer that. Whether it's possible to get these stationary states is another question, and there is now indication that this happens for a number of other subcritical bifurcations. Above all, there is plane Poiseuille flow. There are experiments by Renzo Piva in Rome that show these kinds of behavior also for Poiseuille flow. And there is, of course, the work of Mullin on plane Kreutz flow. Let me close by thanking Armin Schmiegel, who invested a lot of effort in finding all these stationary states, Alois Meersmann, with whom I did the simple model, Kerstin Marcinczyk, that did this calculation over there, Holger Feist, who did the work on Taylor-Kreutz flow, and I have to thank you for your attention.
There must be many questions.
Did I answer yours about sort of what is experimented, what is really going on? It also brings up a question which we haven't settled yet, namely, suppose that you take this theoretical picture and you add noise to it, sort of, both in the system and in your initial conditions. The effect of noise on that is not clear. It could mean that the noise actually makes the thing live longer, because every time it sort of finds an escape hole, the noise drives it away. But it could also induce jumps out of the basin. We don't know yet which goes which. Yeah.
Do you have your diagram with the different colored trajectories with some parameter versus Reynolds number? You're tracking individual states. I just want to make sure I understood.
This one?
That's the one. Okay.
Yeah. So it's Reynolds number one way, and it's energy content of the perturbation the other.
One of these represents a state, but it's an unstable state.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. You were kind of drawing
these there.
And there are many more of these than you say, probably.
You change the symmetry, and you get another set. Same game.
Okay.
Now, clearly, the way to make sense out of that, and this is again what we're working on in a smaller system, there is something called periodic orbit theory, which is a means of making sense out of all these in this case stationary states, but the next step would be to go for periodic ones. In the following sense, you have all these things as the skeleton on which this turbulent dynamics lives. And therefore the turbulent dynamics is, in a sense, the averages you're calculating, average energy, average shear, and things like that, are averages over all these states with the proper weights. Now, the weights come from the instability. The more unstable, the less likely you are to visit there. So there is a way of taking all this information, putting it together, and calculating some numbers. Now, we haven't done it yet for this case, because we would need the periodic ones, but I have a simpler model in which I can show you what this gives. And if you now calculate from these periodic trajectories escape rates, and you compare them to what you see by simply running trajectories, it fits very nicely. So this is the way we're going to make use of all of this information, putting it together.
How many extended dynamical systems have been analyzed thoroughly with periodic
coefficients? Petrak did Kuramoto-Shivashinsky. I worked on the standard map, on the Lorentz attractor, on the Julia set. Yes. Well, what you do is you take the PDE and you reduce it to a few ordinary differential equations. In that sense, you're just cranking up the dimensions. Pardon?
Do you think you would do it with some order 5 or order 1000?
Well, the model we're currently working with has 9 degrees of freedom. And the ones Petrak and Queenside used, maybe 1000.
How many, let's say, spectral modes did you have, and what is the effect of, you know, numerical things, right?
These are all numerical. Energies change a little bit, shear rates change a little bit, stabilities actually change a lot, but their numbers sort of very little effect. We do have a cross-check, you see. One of the guys is running it and playing Qwet, and the other has to find them again in Taylor Qwet. So, and that's different numerical codes, so we are quite sure about the kind of things we see here. There is a way to cross-check.
These are mostly just kind of a wavy vortex?
I don't have a picture here I can show you. They do become a bit more complicated. They become staggered. They are more modulated in downstream directions. So.
What is the message here for experimental science? That is, it's so complicated.
It doesn't. One of the messages to come after this is, if you measure something like this, it may not just be that you're doing a badly controlled experiment.
I think the message is that just for this kind of problem, you can probably learn more from the numerical version from real
sound. For the time being, yes.
Now, before you go, Bill,
the numerical guy thinks the opposite.
I'm a theoretical physicist from Marburg, and as you could see in the sketch beforehand, this is somewhere in the middle of Germany.
Tony Leonard, Aeronautics, Caltech.
Rahul Pandit, Physics, Indian Institute of Science, Bangalore.
Mark Malcolm, Physics, NYU.
Srinivasan from there. I'm Rupert, Physics, 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 Physics,